We believe that alcoholism is a disease and that Alcoholics Anonymous is one solution to that disease. I'm here to bring you the voices of its members. Everyone that comes on the show, including myself, is an active member and has found recovery in the rooms of AA. As you listen, please take what works for you and leave the rest.
Hi, I'm Paul, and I'm an alcoholic. Firstly, thank you for asking me to share. It's a privilege to be asked to do anything for AA, and I really do believe that the program of recovery outlined in this book has saved my life. I'm Paul. I'm 36, and I came to AA for the first time in October 2019, and my sobriety date is the 7th of June 2020. So my story, I grew up in quite a quiet suburb in England. When I was young, it felt to me as there was never much going on. It was kind of a sleepy town, you know, old ladies trimming their rose bushes kind of town, I thought. But we're friends with a lot of our neighbours in our road. They used to throw really good New Year's Eve parties. New Year's Eve was always a big one. We'd usually do fancy dress and the adults would all be drinking and laughing till the early hours. And so my first impressions of alcohol were that it made people laugh. It brought people closer together. And it was what you did to celebrate anything, really. Both my parents drank. My dad's always drunk daily, but I always thought it was strange. He would always drink cider from a small glass and constantly top it up in the kitchen. And I was always think to myself, you know, why not have a bigger glass? But that's just the way he was. My mom was more of a binge drinker. She would wait till Friday night and then she'd go out on the town and really let her hair down. But yeah, the first time I got served in a pub really sticks out as a memory. I was 16 years old and I was with my friend and we were on a hike and we thought we'd try our luck at getting served in this quiet country pub. And being served a pint at a bar for the first time, it made me feel like a gentleman, made me feel sophisticated. Every time I drank, it gave me that warm glow, that feeling of everything feeling right. I lost all my worries about how I looked or what was going to happen, and I just felt present. There are a few warning signs in my early drinking that my behavior around alcohol wasn't normal. One time me and two of my friends got an adult to buy us a crate of beer from a corner store. My friends both had two beers each and they told me to hide the crate of beer at my parents' house for the next week. And when they left and they walked up the road, something came over me and I sat on the street corner in the dark. It was cold, it was winter, and I sat there and I drank the whole crate and staggered back home to my parents' house. And they thought I'd taken drugs with how ill I was afterwards. And they phoned my friend. I said, what have you done to our boy? Another time I was on holiday in Greece with my parents and I stayed at the bar drinking on my own till closing time. And then the bar manager said, you know, why didn't you come out with me clubbing? And I said, no, I've run out of money. And so he lent me some euros and I went out with him after the bar had closed. And I managed to get my head stuck between, God knows how, I managed to get my head stuck between the toilet bowl and the wall. And my dad had to prise me loose. But yeah, drinking in my 20s was fun. It was pubs, parties, clubs. My friends tell me now that it was obvious that my drinking was never normal. And, you know, they normally had to help me get home, whereas they were probably more interested in the girls. I was probably more interested in just getting somewhere else in my own head, really. I loved alcohol and I wanted to be somewhere else or someone else. I was lucky that in my 20s, I had a really caring manager. I think he could see that I was going down the wrong path or that I was a bit lost. And he invited me to come running with him. And I started to enter running races. And that took me down a different path for years of being obsessed with running. And it was kind of for the same reason. It took me out of my own head for a while. I lost a ton of weight. I ran 7 marathons and I made a bunch of like-minded friends. I proposed to my wife and life was good, but I still drank to excess whenever I could. And my healthy friends would pick up on it. You know, we'd be running on a Sunday morning. We'd go out for a half marathon or 15, 16 miles. And they'd say, God, how many beers did you have last night, Paul? And yeah, they could see that something wasn't quite right. So my wife became pregnant with our first child, but she had issues with her hip joints. She started to need crutches, and within a few months, she was in really chronic pain. Our health system here refused to pay for an operation, and that lasted for 2 years. She was in chronic pain, and she needed two operations privately. And yeah, I felt stuck at the time. I felt trapped. You know, I was that person that wanted to be going on adventures. You know, I wanted to go to Scotland and run along Hadrian's Wall. Wanted to do crazy endurance events and really live life to the fullest. But we had a new baby. My wife was suffering, and I was unable to help with her suffering. Sometimes she'd take her pain medication and she'd start slurring her words and pass out, go to sleep. I mentioned this in my shares. I don't know if it was the thing that caused me from moving over that invisible line from being a heavy drinker to an alcoholic, but it is part of my story. And alcohol for me was a tool. It was a way out of my own head. It was like Narnia. It gave me that feeling of ease and comfort that they talk about in the book. Also, they say about seeing others drinking with impunity. And, you know, I'd used to look around at my friends, who some of which drank like me at the time, see people at the bars and think, well, everyone else is doing it, so this must be normal. I think I had a bit of a split personality too, that part of me wanted to be this uber healthy runner, and the other half of me just wanted alcoholic oblivion, basically wanted to drink myself into oblivion. I became more anxious, and then I started to get panic attacks. After a few talks with my wife, I went to a doctor and got diagnosed with depression and anxiety. And they sent me on a counselling course on the phone. And they asked me on this counselling course whether I thought my drinking contributed to my depression. And I said, you know, maybe, but I wasn't really willing to change at the time. It was my crutch. And my alcohol progression was very slow, very subtle. And soon I noticed that I was on a three-day pattern of getting drunk, being hungover, and then having one normal day. And eventually that went to a two-day cycle of just being drunk or just being hungover, and then it was almost daily. I was looking at the alcohol content on, you know, beer cans and just doing an awful lot of maths. You know, if I buy this size at this strength, I will get this many alcohol units in. You know, I used to finish work and get home, and something was always out of place. And I'd make an issue out of nothing. I'd get myself so worked up about something and convince myself that I needed a drink. Manipulate situations as well, like, let's go to the pub for a family meal. Oh, let's stop at the shop afterwards. Oh, we've run out of milk again. What a shame. If I had to be sober, I was irritable and discontent. I used to ruin family meals just with my selfish attitude, really. I didn't want to speak to people if I was sober. All I wanted to do was get home. I was pretty vile to my wife, demanding, selfish, judgmental. Sometimes I blamed her for my drinking, and I tried to deflect the attention away from me by, you know, saying how messy the house was or picking out one of her faults. And yeah, but I didn't hide my drinking from her in the end. I'd have all the cans in the kitchen in the morning, and I'd be crushing them. I didn't bother, because it was too much hard work to hide my drinking from her. I'd rather just tell her, and whatever she thought of it, well, who cares, really? That was where I got in my own head. I see some people in the meetings whose drinking took them on planes. They woke up on a plane to an exotic country, you know, but my drinking left me on my couch drinking on my own every evening, pretty much. I slept on the couch too. I didn't want to sleep to my wife because I knew I stank of booze. Yeah, just the sad reality of it. I felt pretty lonely, and I didn't think that anyone could understand what I was going through. You know, I was hiding how bad it had got from my friends, my family, work, and it was just exhausting to keep it up. I remember one evening when I was determined to go to the corner store to get more beer, and my wife was crying into the washing up, telling me not to go. But, you know, I still went because I was powerless. And I always had a half day at work on Fridays, so I'd pick up my daughter from school, I'd buy enough beer, and I'd try to last until my wife got home from her late shift. And I sort of had a red line in my head that I would never, ever leave my daughter to get more beer. And eventually I crossed that line. You know, I read her a story, I put her to bed, and then quickly got my coat on and ran out the door. And I remember looking up at her bedroom window thinking, how can I do this to my daughter? You know, what if she wakes up? What if my wife comes back early? You know, just no power at all. In the mornings, I'd wake up with severe depression. And one day my wife said to my daughter, you know, go and give daddy a hug. He's having a down day. And my daughter was 6 years old. And she said, really? Again? You know, and she knew at the age of six that something wasn't right. Something was abnormal with me. But all this time I was still holding down the job, had a kind of weird pride that I was a functional alcoholic that was still managing to continue. You know, I managed to take a 3-hour project management exam for work and writing 20 pages in 3 hours, and I passed. Yeah, mad. And I thought to myself, I need to do something. People had said about journaling, so I signed up for a sober journal app. And I was amazed to find that I had already created an account from 9 years before. And 9 years before, it was detailing my struggle to last a week sober. So I just thought to myself, 9 years has gone by and I've just got worse. My mom lived out in Greece and she flew back to try and sort me out. Yeah, she came back for a couple of weeks, but I just wasn't ready. And one time I remember I borrowed my wife's phone to look at the weather forecast, and I opened a web page up and it had a chat on it saying, do I leave my alcoholic husband? And it had loads of responses from other women. And most of the responses were saying, yes, you know, it would do him good. That might give me a wake up call. And that if it didn't give me a wake up call, she'd be glad she left me anyway. I sat there and I knew those women were right, you know. I showed my wife that I'd seen the web page and I cried and I promised her this time would be different. This time I'd stop, but I couldn't. Yeah, I lasted 3 days. It got to the stage where I'd give my wife my wallet and tell her not to give it back to me, you know, and I'd find a quiet toilet at work so no one could hear me be sick. I was suicidal at work. And I went back to the doctors and I was honest with them and they gave me Librium, but that only worked for a week either. So yeah, just feeling stuck, feeling like I've got no, I didn't have a solution to the problem that I had. So I phoned up our local addiction centre and they booked me in for a weekly chat. And I remember I was stood outside this rehab centre thinking, how the hell did I end up here? You know, I've got a good job. I've got a wife who'd gotten better by that point, and I've got a beautiful daughter. I didn't think that I had a past. You know, I didn't have a cause for me to drink like that. But they encouraged me to try AA. So I went to my first meeting. My first thoughts coming into AA were that you all looked a lot better than I thought you would. You were all eloquent and you'd all had really interesting lives. And it did give me, it gave me a profound sense of hope that I'm not alone. But I left my first meeting, yeah, I'd listened to the differences. I thought, but you don't drink like I do. You know, I'd heard of people talking about waking up, talking about reaching for a bottle of scotch in the morning, talking about people coming out of rehab centres in body bags. And I didn't drink like that. I could still wait till I finished work before getting on it, really, before drinking. And yeah, I'd like to say, if there's any newcomers listening to this now, please pick up a big book, as there's a whole chapter starting on page 279 called They Stopped in Time. You know, and some of it states, I've got it open here. They saw that they had become actual or potential alcoholics, even though no serious harm had yet been done. they realized that repeated lack of drinking control when they really wanted to control was the fatal symptom that spelled the problem drinking. This plus mounting emotional disturbances convinced them that compulsive alcoholism already had them, that complete ruin was only a question of time. And that was me. Yeah, I knew I needed to get well. And I started listening to the audio of the Big Book. I started listening to Russell Brand's recovery book, which is all about the steps. And I'd listen to that all day at work in the office. And I did that for about 6 months. And I just couldn't understand how I could listen to 8 hours of recovery and then still go home and drink. I volunteered to do the washing up at the end of a meeting, and I asked one of these old timers how to stop and how to get a sponsor. And quite forcefully, he grabbed hold of my arm and he said, "Get to more meetings." And then COVID happened. So I was working from home. I still had a lot of pride in my job. And I knew it was all like dominoes. If I lost my job, I'd drink more and lose my family. If I'd lost my family, I'd drink more and lose my job. And during lockdown, my friends had organized like online video games on the PlayStation as a way to keep occupied. And I joined in, but having the live chat, having the microphones was like a window into the house that they never had before. They could hear that I was wasted each evening. They reached out to my wife to ask if I had a real serious issue. And of course, she told them it all. She was fed up. She was done by that point. And so the next day, two of my closest friends called me, a video called me. And I was meant to be going into a Zoom meeting for work, but they video called me. And they said that the game was up, that they knew everything now, and it was time to do something before I lost everything. They told me to take 3 weeks off work and try to sort myself out. And it was the scariest moment of my life, I think, because I had so much pride in my job and I didn't want to lose it. But there's also this massive sense of relief that, you know, I've been waiting for this day to come, that I knew it was only a matter of time. And so I phoned my manager and I told him that I had a problem with alcohol and that I just needed to go and sort myself out. And I remember turning to my wife after that phone call and saying, "Yeah, I don't know what to do next." And she just had this look of resignation, you know, that she tried everything already that she could to help me. And she was now pregnant with our second daughter as well. And I still always think of her face before at the start of a meeting. When we have the moment of silence for the still suffering alcoholic, I always think of her face, and it takes me straight back there to why I'm in the meetings today. I phoned the doctors and they said they couldn't help me, and to try talking to the Samaritans, and the Samaritans didn't really have any answers for me either. They just told me to keep talking about it, really. The rehab center was closed due to lockdown, but they said they'd phone me once a week to see how I was getting on. I couldn't get to a physical meeting with AA, but I found that one of my local meetings was going online on Zoom. So the first Zoom meeting, I drove up to the top of our local hill, which overlooks the city, and I joined the Zoom meeting from the car, as I was too embarrassed to do it at home in case my wife or my daughter heard anything. It sounds really silly now, because they'd seen everything for so many years of me drinking, but I was just so embarrassed. But I started to do Zoom meetings every day. I saw that the lockdown had gifted me this opportunity. Like, when is the Prime Minister of the UK ever going to close all the pubs and bars again? This is a godsend. You need to take it. I went to a physical meeting once. Lockdown was finished, and I heard a bloke share, and he talked about his dad died of a heart attack whilst out running. I'd been friends with his dad from my old running club. I asked him to be my sponsor, and he met up with me, and it felt so different that here was this bloke trying to help me, and he didn't have anything to gain from it but his own sobriety. And we went through the first two steps, and we're not that far from Winchester Cathedral here. So I said my third step prayer, at the tombstone of the Hampshire Grenadier, where Bill Wilson had stood all those years before. I got 3 weeks sober, and that just felt unprecedented. I'd never been sober that long since I'd started drinking, and something had changed in me. I started to smile. I started to believe, not just that it was possible, but that it was already working inside me. I wrote out my step four and shared it with my sponsor. And yeah, it revealed a lot of fear and an awful lot of selfishness. I found that going through step six has helped me a lot. Am I willing to have these defects be removed? I read the Drop the Rock book, where it says we need to act as if our defects have been removed in order to let God in, sort of fake it till God makes it. So if I'm fearful of a situation or I have anxiety, I can act in faith that God will provide me with courage, and then he does. I've now worked all the steps, but each of them turns out to be daily. You know, I need to wake up. I need to acknowledge that I'm an alcoholic, hand over my day to God, take inventory as I go, share it with a sponsor, make amends when I can, get stuck into prayer and meditation, and say yes whenever I can do service. I'm a massive proponent of journaling in the morning, writing down things I'm grateful for and things that I need to accept in the day. And in the evening, taking inventory and asking myself, where have I been resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? And what actions do I need to take? I'm not perfect at it by any means. Sometimes it's just a minute or two, but it gets done every day. My sponsor, myself, and two other friends, we've got a WhatsApp group, and we use it to share voice messages. We do our step 10s, and that's been a fantastic tool for taking action. You know, I listen to other gents' issues, you know, and I get criticism on my own, you know, and they've pushed me to take a closer look at myself and make amends that, you know, I hadn't even thought about at the time. My sponsor, he's a shining example of service keeps you sober, and I know it's incumbent upon me to do the same. So I've done a year of finding shares for my local home group, which got me talking to people. I'm somewhat of an introvert when I want to be, and so having to find someone to share for next week's been really good in getting talking to people and getting a phone book full of contacts and people that I can talk to, and they'll come up to me at the next week's meeting and say, "Hi Paul, how's it going?" And it's like, it's so amazing that they actually want to know. You know, they're not just doing it to say hi, and then I actually want to hear about their story as well. I'm currently the secretary at St. Simon's Tuesday night meeting in Southsea. I see newcomers come in and get well. I see the spark in their eyes come back. And we've got a lot of people turning up to our meeting that come from a rehab centre. And you can see the change, you know, week by week. It's fantastic. I've currently got two sponsees, and I've recently done a step five with one of them, and that was so humbling, and you know, such a privilege to be a part of his journey as well. And I'm also the 12-step coordinator for our intergroup, so I keep a list of everyone who's willing to meet up with newcomers when they phone the telephone service and do that 12-step call. Yeah, my faith has grown exponentially. I used to be very anti-religious in my teens, but I really want to improve my conscious contact with God now. I want to get closer to whatever changed me from not being able to go a day without a drink to feeling somewhat tranquil today. I'm very lucky that I work in a place where they've got their own chapel, and there's no one in there except me on the odd lunch time, and I can use that to take a break for quiet prayer or meditation. I'm very lucky that the local town where I live, yeah, it's got a town church that's 900 years old, and there's a meeting there with all the stained glass windows, you know, and I love looking at that and trying to think what the symbolism means now. C.S. Lewis talks about Christianity as being like a hallway with many rooms, many denominations, and that it's much better to be in a room than searching in the hall. Currently, I'm still in the hall, but I'm getting closer, I think. And I think there's a massive parallel there between me searching for a place and me coming into AA now. There's a massive parallel. I don't want to be pounced on by someone in church exactly the same as when I came into AA, and I don't want to get pounced on by an old-timer church member. I'll say to anyone new, it doesn't have to be a God of anyone's understanding but your own. But it says in the book that it should have depth and weight. It needs to be something that we can rely on in those dark times. I've got my running back. So I used to sit on the couch beating myself up for being a big drunken mess. But since entering recovery, I've been running every Sunday with two old friends. I can now enjoy it without obsessing about it. I have run a marathon in sobriety, but the last 2 miles, I was just repeating, you know, thank you to God of my understanding and thank you to AA. I've had a bit of difficulty lately, though, because I want to do AA, I want to do running, and I want to do church properly alongside a full-time job and being a dad of two and a husband. And I think that's part of my alcoholic do everything to the max mentality. You know, I've kind of figured out that for now, going running with my two friends is my church, and we get out in the English countryside or run along the seafront here, and I can be talking to God without anyone even knowing. It can just be between me and him. And there needs to be a balance, you know, so I kind of say just for today, what am I being guided towards? So the mental obsession to drink has left me. A month ago, I had a phone call to say that my mom had fallen over and that she'd hit her head on a lump of concrete. She needed CPR and she was unconscious for 10 hours. And I was just so struck how clear my head was in that moment that on a Saturday evening, I could drop everything and drive an hour to see her in the hospital. Yeah, that I was sober and that I could be there for my mum. I've been able to fly out to Greece to see my dad, who's now on his own, and he's been struggling lately, but I go out and I take my program with me. Yeah, I was worried the first time I flew out there on my own. I was worried what was going to happen. And yeah, I worried whether I was strong enough in my sobriety to do it. But I went out there and I took my journal and I doubled down on it, and it was brilliant. My marriage has been through some hard times, even when I got sober. And for some time, we were very distant, but we've been through a marriage course and working my amends daily just to be here, you know, and now we're able to laugh. We're able to be closer. She's taken on her dream job of working with kids. My youngest daughter's never seen me drink. She's nearly three. Yeah, my relationship with my eldest daughter's good. I haven't sat down with her yet to do like a proper amends. But, you know, I know that I'm always here if she ever wants to talk about it. AA has given me a new group of friends that really get me and how my head works. You know, and I can turn up to a meeting, and if something's not right, I can speak to someone and they're there for me. I still get days when I feel overwhelmed. I still get days where I feel tired and that I'd much rather put my feet up than get to a meeting. Some days Ben and Jerry's Netflix and chilled is my nemesis. But for all the good times and the bad times, yeah, I still need to attend meetings. I still need to work the program and do service and speak to people who may be able to point out where my screwed up thinking has got me. Yeah, alcohol was but a symptom. It was my thinking that got me here. So I need to keep tabs on that. Yeah, and I'm a better me on this journey. I'm a better me, and I'm coming to, I wouldn't say love myself now, but definitely like myself that a little bit more. So yeah, I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. Oh, so you had talked about alcohol being a way out of your head and how it made you feel present. So you're coming up on 3 years. You're 36 years old. How do you, in sobriety, get out of your head without alcohol? And the second part of that question is, how do you remain present without alcohol?
I think definitely now I've got a dog now, and I love going for walks in the countryside with him. And I'd say to anyone in sobriety, get a pair of headphones, get a pair of decent headphones and go walk and use your time wisely. Put on a podcast or put on something meditation or some prayer and just immerse yourself in it. And speak to people as well. Speak to people as much as you can.
Do you find that you're more present today with your girls and your wife? And if so, what does that look like?
Oh, definitely. So last night I took my dog and my daughter, who's 2.5 at the moment, along the seafront here. And I needed to do her little cardigan up because it was cold. And she patted me and she said, "You're a good man to me." And that was it. That was me nearly in tears. But yeah, just trying to understand where they are in their lives now, because you know, it's so easy to get worked up and still think selfishly about everything going on in my world and totally forget that, yeah, I'm just a quarter of the family in my household. And I need to pay real attention to what's going on in their lives as well. Yeah, my daughter's coming up. She's doing her exams at school at the moment. So she's a bit irritable. And it's knowing when to say something.
Not to say anything.
Yeah.
Do you have anxiety or panic attacks or depression?
Not anymore. No, not anymore. Yeah, so I stopped taking my antidepressants a few months into sobriety. Definitely, it's been up and down, but I'm learning to cope, and I don't get panic attacks anymore. Nothing like I used to. But part of it's working the steps and letting go and trying to see my side in it. Yeah,
I find it amazing how blind people seem to be, alcoholics and heavy drinkers and people that just drink casually, this connection between anxiety and alcohol. It seems like an aha moment with people figuring out that the alcohol is causing the anxiety. Not always, but certainly that waking up where your heart feels like it's racing is a physiological reaction alcohol in our system. Not sure, like, if we need, like, a medical campaign, like a worldwide campaign. Alcohol causes anxiety.
Yeah.
Especially as you get older.
Yeah.
So years ago, I don't know how many years ago, it was 2015, there was a billboard in our neighborhood here in California, and it said, you know, it was about this boy having schizophrenia, and I looked at my husband, I remember driving, and I said, "It's the pot. There's all these now marijuana. It's like these edibles. Mm. It's causing people, you know, this causing the schizophrenia." And of course he balked, and that was, you know, he's like, you're projecting. 'Cause that was my experience, right before I got completely sober, was edibles and literally becoming crazy. Mm. And then I just saw now in the news, they're now connecting the increase in schizophrenia to marijuana. And I'm not saying that I'm a genius. I'm just saying sometimes our personal little experience is much bigger than we realize. Much like when you said in your story, you said, "I didn't have a solution. I didn't think anybody else was experiencing what I was experiencing," right?
Yeah, I think that was part of it as well, is that you can label it as depression, but you know, when I had a lot of my depression, it was, I had a really big problem that I couldn't solve, and I could see where I was going. So I was sad because I knew where I was going and I didn't have a way out at the time.
And is that because we're just have like a blind spot to what's happening, or is that because we have a bad opinion about what an alcoholic is?
Yeah.
Or both?
Probably both. Yeah. Certainly my vision of AA before I come was that it was for, you know, park bench drunks, you know, and it wasn't until someone said to me in the room, well, your park bench was your sofa. Changes your perspective. Yeah.
Your other perspective, you telltale sign, you said, I didn't think I had a past or a cause. So that implies that you assumed somebody had to experience a terrible childhood or something to cause the alcoholism.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you think it's caused, or do you think you grew into it, or do you think you came to earth with it?
I don't know. I try not to focus on that too much, that I'm here and I found a way that works for me now, and how I got here doesn't really matter. Yeah.
It does not matter. I ask this question as a mother because I'm always curious, is there anything I can do to help them get there faster? But I hear people say there's nothing anybody could have done differently to change the alcoholism that's in me, whether I came with it or not. Path was my path. It took a source bigger than me to get me out of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not sure I like your quote by, it was C.S. Lewis. Is that what you said?
C.S. Lewis, yeah.
Because I think the most beautiful thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is that I don't have to choose a room. Because a room then puts parameters around what is reality and what's not reality. What works for me changes. What I believed and how I approached my sobriety 1 year in, 5 years in, when it comes to a higher power, is it has to grow and it cannot have boundaries. It cannot have walls.
Yeah.
And I think for me as an alcoholic, it's so restricting that I then don't want any of it. So I don't know that you need to choose a room.
Yeah. Okay.
That's my opinion for the day. That's my psychoanalysis of C.S. Lewis. Okay. You had mentioned AA and running and church and work and being a dad and being a husband. Mm-hmm. What I heard when you were listing that is this heavy weight about you needing to choose a team when it comes to a higher power.
Yeah. I love what you said about the growth, though. Like when I did my step three, you know, I'd said a prayer to probably a much different God than I believe in now. And it's not something that I've, you know, it chose. Yeah, you know, it's something more that's chosen me. It's slowly grown. Yeah.
Is there anything in your story that you're thinking of now or that you left out that you'd like to share?
I'd like to just say I see a lot of people coming into the rooms and they stick around for a while and they think that coming to a meeting's doing AA. Yeah, and it says in Bill's story that we meet frequently so that newcomers may find the fellowship they seek. So to me, the meetings are there primarily so that newcomers can find us, and that then it's our opportunity to take them through this book and get them working this program. And that's what keeps you sober. And I don't think you get to say you've tried AA until you've been through all the steps thoroughly with a sponsor and you're out there working with others.
Really like the way that you put that. I really like that. It's really hard to not respond to AA haters on social media.
Yeah.
But that's such a good quote for them. I won't do it, but that's such a good, like, don't think you get to badmouth it until you've actually tried it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think for anyone who's thinking about coming into the meetings, coming into the fellowship, you're probably thinking about what you're going to miss, you know, your groups of friends, your current lifestyle, your family, you know, when you put the drink down, but you're not able to see at this point what you can gain. And if you could see that, you would take it, you'd bite the person's hand off. You're going to gain the world.
For more information, read the first 164 pages of The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous or visit keepcomingback.net.